Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The United States has the highest incarceration rate in the world. This country represents less than 5% of the world's population, but more than 20% of the world's prisoners. There are more than 2 million people behind bars in America, and for many of them, mandatory minimum sentencing laws put them there for 10, 20, 30 years or more. And for years, prison reform advocates found few friends on Capitol Hill. But that's been changing. There's now bipartisan support for a federal sentencing reform proposal. And last week, President Trump signaled he'd sign the First Step Act if Congress can push it through.
Americans from across the political spectrum can unite around prison reform legislation that will reduce crime while giving our fellow citizens a chance at redemption.
This hour on Point, where we are now with federal criminal justice reform. And you can join us. What changes do you think Congress should make to the criminal justice system, the federal system in particular? What's your view on mandatory minimum sentencing for non-violent offenders, for non-violent drug offenders? And have you or anyone you know ever been affected by these sentencing laws? Tell us your story. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining us first today from Tampa, Florida, is Ojemar Mitchell. He's a professor of criminology at the University of South Florida and author of the book Brick by Brick, Dismantling the Border Between Juvenile and Adult Justice. Professor Mitchell, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Happy to be here.
It's great to have you. Also with us today from Washington is Sean Hopwood. He's now a professor at Georgetown Law School. Prior to that, he spent more than a decade in prison for bank robbery. He wrote about that in the 2012 book Lawman, My Story of Robbing Banks, Winning Supreme Court Cases, and Finding Redemption. Sean Hopwood, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
It's great to have both of you to talk about this really important topic today. So let's just go into some detail about what this new, I guess not, I don't want to call it new, but the current proposal on Capitol Hill, the First Step Act, is actually trying to accomplish. Ojemar Mitchell, let's just start with you. If it passes, and that's a big if, how much of a change would it represent to federal sentencing guidelines?
Well, it would make a huge difference, be a large symbolic difference, but substantively, it only affects a relatively small number of convicted offenders. So I think in many ways it's more symbolic than substantive.
Small number because only roughly 10% of the people behind bars in the United States are there for federal offenses and the rest of them are in state prisons.
Yes, and even among the federal prisoners, a lot of them won't be affected. The proposed legislation rules out violent offenders, those convicted of illegal entry, which is 50% of the current federal prison population, and some drug offenders like those involved in trafficking fentanyl.
Okay. So, Sean Hopwood, let me get your first take here then. You hear Ojemar Mitchell saying that this would be more of a symbolic change than anything else. Would you agree?
I would agree to a certain extent on the sentencing provisions because First Step only really goes after the four worst categories of mandatory minimum sentencing provisions and leave the rest in place. I disagree on the prison reform side, though. I think almost everyone in federal prison will benefit in some way from this bill. The good time provision, which creates additional good time, applies to everyone who has a release date. The bill would force the Federal Bureau of Prisons to put meaningful rehabilitation programs into the federal prison, and it would incentivize some of the people who successfully complete those programs to be released early onto home confinement and halfway houses rather than serving out their sentence in a federal prison. And it has some other unique provisions, like ends the shackling of women during childbirth, and makes it easier for people who are terminally ill to get out of prison and spend their dying days with their
right.
family.
Some compassionate release provisions then in the bill. I mean, there's also guidelines that would eliminate the three strikes penalty for offenders who would face life in prison after committing their third crime. That the life in prison sentence would be reduced to something like 25 years for a certain category of offenders. And I'm seeing that other mandatory minimums for, say, serious drug offenses could be reduced to 15 years from 20 years. So Ojemar Mitchell, again, I take your point about the big picture regarding how many people and who's incarcerated in the United States. But are some of these specific provisions, though, they still seem to be rather momentous given where we've come in the United States. It was just a generation ago where it seemed as if, the federal government and almost every state just enthusiastically embraced mass incarceration.
You're absolutely right. Still to this day, most of the war on drugs and tough on crime movement, those policies still are on the books. So this is a really important change. But when you look at the absolute length of these sentences, they're going from 20 years to 15 years, 25 to 20 years. They're still really long and disproportionate when you consider what happens at the state level.
Right. So tell me more about that. What do you see? What do we see at the state level?
At the state level, when the offenses align, a lot of federal crimes aren't state crimes and vice versa. But when you look at things that are common crimes in both systems, what you see is the states have much less severe punishments for the same crimes in the federal system.
Okay. And so, Sean Hopwood, your thoughts on that?
Well, that's true. And I get his point. I mean, listen, if we had a bill that released all 180,000 federal prisoners tomorrow, the United States would still lead the world in incarcerating mm-hmm. its citizens. So, the federal system is one of 51 systems. I think where this bill is encouraging is that in my 43 years of life, the U.S. Congress has passed three reform bills that made the system better and not worse. This would be the fourth in 43 years, and it's significantly better than anything Congress has ever thought about passing before. And so the hope is this will be just a first step to get some forward momentum in the federal system for the first time in decades, and hopefully there will be more reforms on the horizon.
Right. So that forward momentum then being the reason why the symbolic importance of this bill, the First Step Act, I think that's what a lot of people are focusing on. I mean, because some of the provisions, for example, federal sentences, the one about they could no longer be stacked for first-time offenders who were charged with crimes while possessing a firearm, right? That would only possibly, I'm seeing, according to the United States Sentencing Commission, affect about 60 offenders a year, so not very many. But people looked at that stacking of offenses regarding with the firearms charges as one of the ways that nonviolent drug offenses, for example, ended up with people in prison for decades. So the symbolic importance of that. And then what about the 3,000 inmates that would possibly have a retroactive application of that 2010 law that sought to eliminate disparities in sentencing between crack and powdered cocaine? Sean, your thoughts about that?
Well, I don't think any of those changes are just symbolic.
Okay.
The 924 stacking provision could have been applied to me. If I had been sentenced under Jeff Sessions' sentencing memo, instead of a 12-year, 3-month offense or sentence, I would have received 92 years and 3 months in federal prison, and you all would be paying for me to spend the rest of my life in prison.
Yeah.
Those 3,000 people who received extraordinary long mandatory minimums and maximum sentences for crack cocaine offenses, which the Congress now says were completely unfair, but were unwilling to go back and fix people that had been sentenced before the law in 2010 passed, that could release thousands of people who have been serving excessive and long sentences to begin with and who really deserve a second chance at life.
So, let's just take a step back here for a second. And Ojemar Mitchell, I'll come back to you in a few minutes, I promise. But since Sean Hopwood just did mention, once again, Sean, you mentioned your own experience in federal prison. I mean, I'd love to hear a little bit more of this story, right? Because it gives you a perspective that that we ought to acknowledge more clearly. So in 1998, you pleaded guilty to robbing what, four banks in Nebraska at gunpoint?
Five.
Okay. So tell us about that. What led you to bank robbery in the 90s?
Well, I was, like so many young men, young and reckless and immature, made horrible decisions, didn't think about the consequences of my actions on myself, so it was pretty easy to not think about the consequences of my actions on others. And I was sentenced to 12 years, 3 months. And what I'd tell you, the great and cruel irony of the American criminal justice system is, the longer we tend to send people to American prisons and the American correctional system, the less likely they are to return corrected, law-abiding, successful citizens. And so this First Step bill would really force the Federal Bureau of Prisons to do things differently. And the hope is, using these evidence-based practices, we will reduce the risk of people coming home and committing new offenses, which is why almost every American should be embracing the First Step Act.
Mm. Definitely take your point and agree with you that we've been cutting back tremendously over time on the resources available to inmates in this country that would hopefully allow them so we could reduce recidivism rates. But your story is almost the exact opposite, that it was in prison that you entered into the world of law. You ended up writing briefs to the United States Supreme Court that the court took up, and now here you are these many years later as a professor at Georgetown Law School.
My rehabilitation was in spite of the Federal Bureau of Prisons and not because of. In 11 years, I never met one staff member who said the word rehabilitation. And I had some resources that many others in federal prison did not. And so I don't think you can draw too much from my own experience other than what I saw, which was that most people in federal prison could come home and have redemption and be law-abiding, successful citizens. They just need a little help. You know, the RAND Corporation estimates for every $1 we spend on education and job training in prison, we save 4 or 5 on the back end when they get out and do not commit new crimes.
Yeah. Well, Sean Hopwood joins us today. He's a professor at Georgetown Law School, and as you heard, he spent almost a dozen years in federal prison in the late 90s and early 2000s. Ojemar Mitchell is also with us. He's a criminologist and associate professor at the University of South Florida, and we're talking about bipartisan support around a bill in Congress called the First Step Act and whether or not it signals possibly new momentum around criminal justice reform and sentencing reform in the United States. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the First Step Act. It is a bill pending in Congress that now has bipartisan support and support as well from President Donald Trump that would introduce some reforms to federal sentencing guidelines. Some people look at it as the possibility of momentum around criminal justice reform in the United States today. We're joined by Ojemar Mitchell. He's criminologist and associate professor at the University of South Florida. Sean Hopwood is also with us. He is a professor at Georgetown Law School and author of Lawman, My Story of Robbing Banks, Winning Supreme Court Cases, and Finding Redemption as well. And I just want to play some tape here on what some key voices on Capitol Hill are saying about the First Step Act. First, you'll hear Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell speaking to reporters on Wednesday, saying that he's not yet ready to commit to moving the proposal forward in the lame duck session.
On criminal justice, what I've said to the proponents is that we need a kind of final agreement. There's been a lot of discussion, but we need a actual proposal. Then we would take a whip count, see where we stand, and then weigh it at that point against the other things that absolutely have to be accomplished.
That's Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. He later told the president, we're seeing reports from the New York Times, for example, that it's very unlikely that this bill will be addressed in the lame duck session. So here's South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, one of the architects of the First Step reform legislation, saying yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press that the biggest obstacle to passing it in the Senate might be Mitch McConnell.
I never dreamed that this many Republicans and Democrats would embrace sentencing reform and prison reform. I'm urging Senator McConnell to bring the bill to the floor of the Senate. It would get 80 votes. Mr. President, pick up the phone and push the Republican leadership. The Republicans are the problem here, not the Democrats.
That's Republican Senator Lindsey Graham. Ojemar Mitchell, let's talk about this for a second, because hearing Lindsey Graham say that this bill would get 80 votes, that it's got bipartisan support, and that Mitch McConnell may be the problem, just is it remarkable that there is so much support on either side, on both sides of the aisle, for at least some reform, whether or not it's as monumental as the nation's criminal justice system might need?
It is a little bit surprising given the lack of movement on these issues that we've seen over the years. If you look at what happened in the House of Representatives, 85% of those voting supported this legislation. So it's not unreasonable to expect 80 votes in the Senate as well. What's surprising is we're at this point right now. How did we get here is pretty eye-opening, you know, because just a decade ago, we were doubling down on a lot of these provisions.
Right. So let's talk about that. I mean, what do you see as some of the primary forces for how we got here to this point?
Oh, I'm convinced it's the public. If you look at public support, public opinions on criminal justice reform, the overwhelming majority of Americans support it. So, for example, a 2017 poll found that 91% of Americans thought that the criminal justice system has problems that need fixing. 71% believe that too many people are in prison. The same 71% of people found or believe that incarceration is often counterproductive. So what you see here is just this growing support for criminal justice reform, and politicians have been squeamish to do anything about it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I actually want to jump in the Wayback Machine a little bit here and take us back to 1995. And this is what then-President Bill Clinton said in his 95 State of the Union address, because he highlighted a major criminal justice reform bill, quite an aggressive one, that he signed in 1994.
I know the members of this Congress are concerned about crime, as are all the citizens of our country. But I remind you that last year we passed a very tough crime bill. Longer sentences, 3 strikes and you're out, almost 60 new capital punishment offenses, more prisons, more prevention, 100,000 more police.
More prisons, more prevention, more police. That's then-President Bill Clinton in 1995 talking about the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act. It was the largest crime control bill in U.S. history. Clinton later apologized for that, and we'll talk about that in a second. But Sean Hopwood, I mean, it wasn't just Republicans or just Democrats. Virtually every politician was speaking in those terms just a generation ago.
Yeah, no one comes with clean hands to this battle. Democrats and Republicans in Congress and through several presidents have only ratcheted up the criminal justice system. More prisons, longer sentences, longer time served in prison, and very few resources pegged for actually rehabilitating people in prison. And it's encouraging to see Republicans taking a lead and having a bill that they are really pushing for. That is certainly a change from things that I have witnessed in the past. And I think you're going to see, if this bill goes to the floor of the Senate, most Democrats are going to support it. Most Republicans are going to support it. There may be 15 or less Republicans who will actually vote against the First Step Act. And, you know, that's all encouraging signs.
Yeah. Well, so I wonder what you make of the fact that we're seeing this confluence of different reasons, different approaches, but leading to the same conclusion that there is a mass incarceration problem in the United States, right? I mean, there have been many advocates for a long time saying that we have incredible racial disparities in incarceration rates in this country. There's no doubt about that. We also now have many conservatives saying it's costing the country too much. I mean, back in 2007, then Governor Rick Perry in Texas was appalled that when he got a projection that Texas would need some 14,000 more prison beds, it would cost the state $500 million. So he looked for, other like drug court solutions versus straight incarceration. And I'm also seeing, for example, other conservatives. Senator Mike Lee recently wrote an op-ed saying that common sense sentencing reform can increase trust in the criminal justice system, and he sees it as a good idea because excessive prison sentences break apart families and weaken communities, the very building blocks of American civil society. So Odemar Mitchell, I guess I'm wondering, do these reasons hold water for you, or in your opinion, does it matter that people can have whatever makes them feel right about sentencing reform is fine as long as we get to some sort of new era in how we're dealing with criminal justice?
Well, I think one of the big reasons people have gotten to the point where they're looking for a different solution, a better solution, is that the old solution didn't work.
Yeah.
Long prison sentence didn't reduce crime. Crime was already falling when Bill Clinton announced the Violent Crime Control Act of 1994 and signed it into law. We see again and again that no matter how you study it, more prisons, longer sentences doesn't affect crime. Other approaches do negatively affect the crime rate. And I think the voters understand that at this point.
Well, let's get some calls in here. We're talking about a bill pending in Congress, the First Step Act. It has bipartisan support, and it would signal quite a change, or at least something of a change, in federal sentencing guidelines for mandatory minimums. And people are seeing it more broadly as, you know, could it be momentum for a bigger change in terms of how we view criminal justice in the United States. Let's go to Art, who's calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Art, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Most welcome. What do you have to share?
Well, listening to you about the criminal system and 35 years ago, a little sometime like that, I had an incident that occurred, and I got out and I had done nothing but, you know, redeem myself. But even, you know, 2016, I got on with Home Advisor, and I'm in residential painting. And I told them the story, letting them know up front that I had a felony on me. They took me on board. 2 years later, they terminated me for the past. I got nothing but 5-star ratings. And it didn't make sense, you know, after 35 years that I have showed nothing but a continuous service to the community and to self-development. And then the criminal system is just really rough on trying to redeem yourself. It makes it very difficult for you to be able to get back into society, no matter how long that you've been, you know, done the right thing.
Yeah. Art, thank you so much for your call. Sean Hopwood, reflect on what Art brings to the table here about how basically it's very impossible to fully or challenging to fully get back on your feet even after you've served your time here.
It's one of the reasons why I don't like the term returning citizen for someone that comes out of prison, because no one comes back to the community a full citizen. When we measure justice in this country, we only think about the number of days, weeks, months, or years that someone spends in prison. But when they get out, there is a whole new punishment. There are 3,000 to 4,000 collateral consequences of a felony conviction. You can be legally discriminated against in housing, employment, public benefits, voting rights, and many other things. And if we're ever expect to reduce recidivism fully, we need to allow people to come home and have a second opportunity, a second chance. It's not only good to reverse some of the harm of prison and the criminal justice system, but it also makes good public policy. When people feel like they can get out and live the American dream and have upward mobility, they're a lot less likely to get out and commit new crimes. And so we need to be a more forgiving society on the whole.
Well, let's go to John, who's calling from Detroit, Michigan. John, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. So I just was wondering what the economic makeup of the prison systems is, and I reference this because of how much money we don't spend on education versus how much we spend on the incarceration mm-hmm. process.
John, thank you for your call. Ojemar Mitchell, walk us through this. What's the socioeconomic breakdown of America's prison population?
The socioeconomic breakdown of those in prison is the same as it's always been. Most of the people who are incarcerated are poor. They're disadvantaged. They come from disadvantaged backgrounds. And like the last caller, Art, talked about, when they go home, those disadvantages are further exacerbated. And that brings me to my point about why I think this law, these laws are largely symbolic, is they don't go far enough. I think they're a great first step, but they're a baby first step. And what we need to do, instead of just focusing on reducing the amount of time people spend in prison, we need to pull that other policy lever and divert some of these people from going into the system in the first place. That would cause people like Art to not have had the collateral consequences he's been facing and dealing with both over the last several years.
Yeah. Well, you know, I want to bring one more voice into this conversation, someone who can give us the perspective of being on the bench in the federal justice system here. Judge Nancy Gertner joins us now. She is a retired Massachusetts federal judge and now senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Judge Gertner, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Meghna.
So tell us, I mean, you sat on the bench in a Massachusetts federal court for years. What was it like being a judge and having, you know, your leeway kind of significantly constricted by mandatory minimums and federal sentencing guidelines?
Well, the only way I can describe it is what I'm writing about now, which is that I was on the bench for 17 years. That I sentenced hundreds and hundreds of mostly young African-American men to sentences which I believed then and believe now 80% of which were unjust, disproportionate, and unfair. So what does it feel like? It felt, it was horrendous because you knew that what you were doing was wrong. Yeah. You knew what you were doing is wrong, and the most that you could do would be to try to mitigate the harsh effects of the mandatory sentencing when you could, and write about it and, you know, scream about it when you could not do anything.
Okay, so can you give us an example of a case or two that epitomizes this?
Well, for example, one person that I'm writing about now was when his parents, when he was 14, his parents who were dealing crack were kicked out of their house. The kids were on the street. He started to deal crack essentially to get school supplies for his siblings, not to buy a fancy car, not to tool around as a major drug dealer. The kinds of people that President Clinton was talking about was not the people I was sentencing. And he wound up with a mandatory minimum sentence of 10 years. The government, the police would hang on the block and watch him, you know, multiple times until the quantities hit a mandatory minimum quantity, and that's what he got. And there was nothing I could do but rail about it. Somebody else who I just met, I'm meeting some of the people that I sentenced, who at 40 told me he just learned to read. And his illiteracy, his failure to be able to function in the modern world, was clearly the reason why he was dealing crack. That was the only job that he could sort of figure out doing.
Well, so
and he also did a substantial amount of time.
So, Judge Gertner, though, if you had total discretion, which, by the way, this bill does not purport to give judges the total discretion, a little bit more than they had before, but if you had total discretion, what would you have sentenced him?
Well, one of the things we know about we know more than we did, in 1995 about addiction. So a vast majority of the people that I've sentenced had impairments because of drug addiction. We know about it. We know how to intervene. We know how to do something about that. We know how to do something about mental health issues. We know sometimes it was a question, actually, in going back over the people I sentenced, sometimes it was an issue not just of whether I knew what to do, but it was clear that what I was doing was wrong. In other words, if you have someone who is illiterate at 40, giving him a 15 or 10-year sentence doesn't do anything to address that. In other words, you didn't need 15 or 20 years to teach him to read. You didn't need 15 or 20. And in fact, what we were doing in these kinds of sentences, which the First Step Act only ameliorates to a limited degree, what you've done is made it even harder for them to reintegrate, you even longer away from their families, even longer periods of time outside of any economic system, longer periods of time, outside of any school system. So I know what not to do, and I could see that over 17 years.
Right.
I now have some sense of what to do with respect to mental health and addiction and some of the issues of youthful offenders. And that's what we ought to work on.
Well, so Judge Gertner, we've just got about 30 seconds to go before we take a break here. But let me ask you, I mean, Ojemar Mitchell has very clearly said that he, too, believes that the First Step Act is just it's a first step. But I'm wondering, given the way Congress works, are you concerned that that senators and representatives may end up, you know, if this even gets to a vote, pat themselves on the back for criminal justice reform and then say, like, we're done now, that perhaps this could be a wasted effort when much more change is needed, as I'm hearing you say?
Well, there's no question about that. There's no question about that. And we have to deal with the habits of retribution, of a 30-year retributive model, which we have to figure out how to get out of.
Okay, well, Judge Gertner, stand by. Sean Hopwood and Ojemar Mitchell, hang in there for a second as well. We're talking about bipartisan support around a piece of legislation that could signal, maybe, a new era in how we think about federal prison sentencing guidelines. We'll be right back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the First Step Act. It's a proposal currently in Congress that would change some sentencing guidelines for federal crimes and whether or not we should look at it as a new era of bipartisan support for criminal justice reform in the United States. I'm joined today by Ojemar Mitchell. He's a criminologist and associate professor at the University of South Florida. Sean Hopwood is also with us. He's a professor at Georgetown Law School. And Judge Nancy Gertner joins us as well. She spent 17 years on the bench in a Massachusetts federal court. And I'd just like to we've been talking about bipartisan support around this bill with all of you this hour. But bipartisan doesn't mean absolute or total support, of course, right? Because Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton, for example, is a stalwart opponent of the First Step Act. I mean, he calls it the jailbreak bill, and he sees it as a threat to public safety. And in addition, I mean, he's no longer Attorney General, but former Attorney General Jeff Sessions for the longest time was one of the most influential voices for as strong sentencing guidelines as, you know, one could possibly come up with. And I think, Sean, you mentioned this earlier in the hour, that it was just last year in May of 2017 when then Attorney General Sessions actually announced an updated sentencing policy for the U.S. Department of Justice.
Going forward, I have empowered our prosecutors to charge and pursue the most serious offense, as I believe the law requires, most serious, readily provable offense. It means that we're going to meet our responsibility to enforce the law with judgment and fairness. It is simply the right and moral thing to do.
That's then Attorney General Jeff Sessions last year in May. Sean Hopwood, let me ask you about that, because Judge Gertner before the break was talking about the model, the moral model around criminal justice in the United States, and it is a punitive one. And there's still lots of influential voices who believe that's the right model for this country. Are you seeing a change there or not fundamentally?
I'm seeing a change in some places, in part because the criminal justice system became so big, it's impacted far more families than it ever has before. We're talking 2.3 million American or people in American prisons, maybe another 10 million more on parole, supervised release, or some form of supervision. And then we may have up to 25 million people in America who have felony convictions. And that started to impact more than just poor people. And because of that, I think some people are coming around to the idea that this was too much, overly punitive. But, you know, even when cultural change happens, legal change is sometimes slow to take place. And I agree with others that the First Step Act is not enough. But for a Congress that doesn't generally pass reform hardly at all, I'm thankful that this is at least a good step in the right direction.
Mm. Judge Gertner, what do you think?
Well, I think that to undo 30 years of punitiveness will take considerable doing. And while we have seen some of that, I mean, ironically, the 2008 recession made people, you know, introduced a whole new set of voices here, which is Republicans dealing with right, Lindsey Graham among them, talking about right on crime and dealing with, talking about how incredibly, how not cost-effective the criminal mm-hmm. justice system is. Not doing it because it was an issue of dignity or rights or anything like that, but because, in fact, as a cost-benefit analysis, this made no sense. And that's helpful. But I'm more concerned about how Attorney General Sessions can be touting, for example, just as one voice, continue to tout a criminal justice system that we know is not effective in reducing crime. Crime rates have fallen regardless of those policies. And that, therefore, is only punishment for punishment's sake, largely against African Americans in our society.
Right.
What habit of mind enabled that even to be considered a legitimate statement in these days?
Well,
that's what we have to address.
In these days, maybe, but he was definitely not alone a generation ago. I mean, we talked about that a little earlier, right? How President Bill Clinton very proudly said he had signed the strongest criminal justice reform act in U.S. history back in 1994. It was a centerpiece of the State of the Union then. But Sean Hopwood, I know we have to let you go here in just a minute, so I want to turn one last question to you, because we have lots of comments coming in on our website along these lines. Stephen Newton says, what do your guests have to say about the complete monetization of every aspect of the criminal justice system so that U.S. companies are making a profit on prisoners and thereby slowing real reform? They also lobby for legislation that makes it nearly impossible for released prisoners to avoid recidivism. Your thoughts, Sean?
Well, that's a very complex topic. It's one that I get that question everywhere I go do a speaking event about criminal justice reform. And what I'd say is we need to reduce the amount of privatization in the correctional systems. There's no doubt about that. But it wasn't just privatization that got us mass incarceration. It was Americans from both parties who were scared about crime and thought that this was an effective way of dealing with it. And we just now have realized with more data and more awareness that this was not effective policy and that it was incredibly unfair because it targeted certain communities but not others. So, you know, I wouldn't want to see an entire prison system that doesn't have any privatization, because the only model I've seen that has that is places like Angola down in Louisiana, where the people in prison have to grow their own food. Mm. There's going to be a certain amount of privatization in any of the correctional system. But we need to reduce the level we have now.
Yeah. Well, Sean Hopwood is a professor at Georgetown Law School and author of Lawman, My Story of Robbing Banks, Winning Supreme Court Cases, and Finding Redemption. It's been really great to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's let some callers in here. Thomas is calling from Owingsville, Kentucky. Thomas, you're on the air.
Hello, Magna. Thank you for taking my call.
Most welcome. What would you like to say?
I was a prosecutor for over 39 years, and I retired. I now practice some defense law, and I have a son who's in federal prison right now. And I also have a number of clients who are in federal prison right now. And I would strongly encourage my senator, Senator Mitch McConnell to do everything he could to bring this to the vote and pass it. I think it's a very important law, and I think it's very, very timely.
Yeah. Thomas, let me ask you, why'd you move from being a prosecutor to being a defense attorney?
Well, I figured 39 years was sufficient time, and I figured that it was time for a little change, so I thought that I would do that.
Okay, because you just heard we played
I retired.
I'm sorry, I was just going to say we played that tape just a couple of minutes ago of then-Attorney General Jeff Sessions in 2017 saying he wanted to empower federal prosecutors, at least, to pursue charges on the most serious offenses possible. So what was your experience like? I don't know, if were you a local or state-level prosecutor in Kentucky?
I was a state-level prosecutor.
Yeah. Okay. And
that was a little draconian, I thought. I mean, I can understand where he's coming from, right? But you've got to use a little bit of common sense with it, I think.
Yeah.
And I think he was going a little bit overboard.
Well, Thomas, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to David, who's calling from New Orleans. David, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call on such an important issue. So in New Orleans, I think it's especially important talking about prison reform because not only is the United States the leading incarcerator in the world, but then Louisiana State is the leader of the 50 states. And then New Orleans, if it's not the top, it's second or third statewide as far as incarceration goes. And we just had some promising developments here. We had a ballot initiative to end convictions based on non-unanimous juries. I think that was a huge win for prison reform here. Now it's just up to Oregon to end convictions on non-unanimous juries. But I think something I'd like to put forward to your panel and your audience at large, I think the main thing we need to do as far as prison reform to get to the next level is de-incentivize prison labor. As it is, I think that means a constitutional amendment on the 13th Amendment. As it is, you can use labor as a punishment based on that. And so in my opinion, it's basically legalized slavery. Mm-hmm. And I think as long as we have that incentive for municipalities to have cheap prison labor, Orleans Parish, you'll see it every Mardi Gras. They have prisoners out there sweeping up. There's prisoners that work in the governor's mansion. And I mean, even just in California with the wildfires,
right,
most of those firefighters are prison labor. And so I think that is something that we as a nation need to amend the 13th Amendment so that prison labor is not a financial incentive for municipalities to continue these draconian sentences,
yeah,
because they rely on that cheap labor to balance their books.
I hear you, David. Thank you so much for your call. Ojemar Mitchell, do you want to respond to David?
Well, David might find it interesting that the First Step Act includes provisions that would allow more prison labor. So it's not that prison labor necessarily motivates draconian sentences. You can do both at the same time. According to this bill, you can reduce the severity of punishment and at the same time increase the proportion of people working in prison industries. But, you know, Magna, I think it's really important that your listeners understand that what Senator Cotton said about this being a jailbreak act, mm-hmm, and it's going to hurt public safety, that's completely false. Doesn't square with the legislation at all. Because in order for anyone to get out early, according to this bill, they have to be actively and successfully engaged in recidivism reduction programming, evidence-based programming. They're going to have to do it over a consistent amount of time. So when they come out, they are not going to be at high risk for recidivism. And on top of that, what we haven't talked about is 75% of those in the federal prison system are risk assessed at low risk or low moderate risk. We are not talking about Ted Bundy.
Mm-hmm. Well, Judge Gertner, let me turn back to you here because we've got another question here on our website from someone calling themselves Nelson Law. I think exploring a philosophical question here that the cost of enforcing laws is expensive, but what is the cost of crime on society? How would you answer that?
Well, one of the things that criminologists and sociologists have studied, the National Academy of Science notably, was that, in fact, our sentencing has only a marginal effect. Onerous sentences had only a marginal, if any, effect on the crime rate. So the utilitarian concept of, you know, you increase punishments and it will reduce the crime rate is simply not true, and certainly was not true for, you know, 20, 30 life sentences for drugs. We know that not to be true. Now, on the other hand, one of the things that it would be wonderful to have more programs in prison to address recidivism. I've actually been intrigued by suggestions that some have made that we actually need a Marshall Plan for the communities that have been affected by mass incarceration. The numbers of men who have been affected by mass incarceration, the numbers of families, the numbers of communities. So this is a very important first step, but it really is, again, only a first step. You have to deal with the damage we have actually already done in addition to the damage we will do if we don't change going forward.
Right. So Ojemar Mitchell, on that point, in the midterm elections in Florida, Florida voters voted to give to restore voting rights to ex-felons in that state, and if I remember correctly, I'll get the right number here, but that one change I think may have re-enfranchised some 40% of the black male population in Florida.
Yeah, that's a shocking statistic, but it's correct. This was an absolutely monumentous occasion to restore voting rights for those disenfranchised because of felon disenfranchisement. But what I find interesting about this is this historic piece of legislation passed not through an act of Congress, legislator. It passed because the people supported it. This goes back to my point. Politicians have been squeamish about criminal justice reform, but the public has been calling for it consistently. If you look at other reforms that have occurred in recent years, in the last decade or so, recreational marijuana, medical marijuana, legislation that requires treatment for drug addiction instead of incarceration. Almost all of those provisions have passed at the ballot box, not in Congress.
Hmm. Wow. Well, let's see if we can get one more call in here. Suzanne is calling from Richmond, Virginia. Suzanne, we've just got about a minute and a half left, but go ahead.
I just wanted to say that I fully agree with the judge about our draconian methods. And I think that Virginia being one of the – well, right now Virginia has the lowest recidivism in the country for the past 2 years because we're using the evidence-based what works with the offenders before they hit the streets and when they hit the streets. So we're teaching them new skills so that they're less likely to recidivate, and it's working. So Virginia currently, since 2016, has the lowest recidivism in the country because of this new stuff that we're doing.
Right. Well, Suzanne – yeah, Suzanne, thank you so much for your call and for your perspective there as a retired probation and parole officer. Judge Gertner, we've got a minute left here. Let me just go back to a fact that we started off with at the beginning of this hour, that this First Step Act, if it ever gets through Congress, most likely will not happen in this lame duck session. But if it or another version of it does get through Congress, we're still only talking about federal sentencing, federal criminal justice reform, whereas most of the people incarcerated in the United States, more than 1.5 million of them, it's happening at the state level. So your last thought on where we are now?
Well, the conversation has to begin somewhere. The federal government essentially put a megaphone to those in state legislatures that thought that the only way to deal with crime was through punishment. We have to go back to the point where we ask what works, what makes sense, what will make a difference, as opposed to, you know, what punishment enables us to vent our spleen about crime. I mean, we have to go back to figuring out a more rational criminal justice policy, federal and state.
Yeah. Well, Judge Nancy Gertner, a retired Massachusetts federal judge and now senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
And Ojemar Mitchell, criminologist and associate professor at the University of South Florida, author of Brick by Brick, Dismantling the Border Between Juvenile and Adult Justice. Ojemar Mitchell, thank you so very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
And by the way, that fact about how many Florida voters are re-enfranchised as a result of the midterm elections around restoring felony voting rights, it's almost 20% of all voting age black Floridians. So a huge number there. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.